Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Anna Fishzahn, and today I'm excited to be speaking with Bruce Fink once again, this time about his brand new book, A Clinical Introduction to Freud, Techniques for Everyday Practice, from Norton 2017. So just for... Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Anna Fishzahn, and today I'm excited to be speaking with Bruce Fink once again, this time about his brand new book, A Clinical Introduction to Freud, Techniques for Everyday Practice, from Norton 2017. So just released. Bruce, welcome back.
Thank you, Anna, and it's such a pleasure and an honor for me to be invited back again by you.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's a pleasure for me to introduce you for a third time. Bruce Fink is a practicing Lacanian psychoanalyst and analytic supervisor who trained at the École de la Cause Freudienne in Paris. He is the author of numerous books on Lacan, including The Lacanian Subject, Between Language and Jouissance, A Clinical Introduction to Lacanian Psychoanalysis Theory and Technique, Lacan to the Letter, Reading a Crete Closely, Fundamentals of Psychoanalytic Technique, A Lacanian Approach for Practitioners, Against Understanding, Volumes 1 and 2, about which I have interviewed Bruce on this very podcast, and more recently, Lacan on Love, an exploration of Lacan's Seminar 8, Transference. He's also translated several books of several of Lacan's works into English, including Ecrit, of course, the first complete edition in English, Seminar 20, Encore, and Seminar 8, Transference. And also, finally, in his spare time, he's written several mysteries. One of these days we'll talk about those, involving a character loosely based on Lacan. But anyway, today we will be talking about Freudian technique. So, Bruce, I'm compelled to ask you the obvious question first, I guess. What prompted your return to Freud? Why did you decide to write a book on Freudian technique specifically after writing so much, on Lacanian technique?
For me, I guess it's not so much a return to Freud. Freud is where it all started, and it's where it all started for me, too. I was quite familiar with Freud's work before I discovered Lacan, and it's, of course, what allowed me to get a first handle on Lacan. And as you're aware, I'm sure, Lacan himself, throughout his life and all the way to the end, said, he was a Freudian. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a certain amount of rhetoric, perhaps, involved in that statement. But the idea is that, he was first and foremost a Freudian, and certainly for probably the first decade of his teaching, every year he took a Freudian text and worked it over and worked it over in his seminar. And so, he began as one of the closest readers of Freud's work at his time, and certainly in France, where Freud's work was not very quickly translated, often very badly translated, and often sort of stepped over, or whatever the term is, sort of skipped by analysts of his time, because they would read summaries of it, often by English-speaking authors. So for me, Freud is where it all begins, and it's also the basis of Lacan's work. You know, his work on dreams, his work on slips of the tongue, on everything that he calls unconscious formations, all grows directly out of Freud's work. Mm-hmm. In my teaching that I did for 20 years at Duquesne University, I often taught an undergraduate and a graduate class on Freud. And I thought there was a lot of good material in there that would be worth bringing out, because my sense is that today many people are not that familiar with Freud's work, even in psychoanalytic institutes. It's obviously true in psychology programs, because Freud is often given very short shrift. Textbooks that people read, will have one chapter, if you're lucky, on Freud, and often a very superficial reading of Freud. And so it seemed to me that both for students and for practitioners, a book that focused on Freud and not on Freud at what a horrible person he was, or how did he really help his patients or not, and is his theory somehow outmoded, but to really talk about the techniques that he introduced that are still useful to us as clinicians today, it seemed to me that that was worth going into.
Because you've written so much on Lacan, I feel compelled to ask, what do you think is the biggest difference between classical Freudian and Lacanian technique? I mean, besides, of course, the variable length sessions, is there a big difference really between Freudian and Lacanian approaches to transference, for example, or interpretation?
Yeah, I think there is a very big difference, and I think it's best to see it in a kind of historical perspective. If we talk about interpretation, first of all, Freud, very early on in his work, thought that it was enough for him to think that he had discovered what was unconscious in his patient, and bring it to the patient's attention in a very direct, not ambiguous communication. Mm-hmm. And so he would say, well, you're doing this because you're in love with your mother and you hate your father. And he found very quickly that such interpretations didn't have any effect anymore. In fact, his patients would come to him, some of them had begun to read his work very early on, and they'd say, I'm here because of my Oedipus complex. And these kind of banal interpretations, but not even just banal interpretations, any interpretation that conveyed a piece of knowledge that the analyst thought he or she had come up with to the patient turned out not really to have the desired effect. Or we could look at it historically and say it stopped having the desired effect starting at some point. Lacan tries to situate this around the 1920s, for example. But Freud himself says already in his papers on technique that there is knowledge and then there is knowledge, that there's a kind of knowledge that can be explicitly articulated, and then there's a kind of knowledge that you feel in your bones, and that actually has to come from the patient, him or herself. If it comes from the analyst, it remains a kind of foreign, external thing. And so I think what Lacan's approach was not to hand interpretations over to the analysand, but rather to try to prod and encourage the analysand to come up with the interpretations him or herself. And this makes analysis a longer process. I think Freud was very impatient. He wanted his analyses to gallop along and, you know, given the work that he did early on as a neurologist and so on, he was used to treatments not taking more than a few weeks and even a few months. In the case of Dora, you may recall, he sort of apologizes to his audience that he wasn't able to completely, you know, come to a resolution of the case in 3 months. But even later on in his work, and you can read this in certain accounts that people have given of their analyses with Freud, it was clear that he really wanted things to move ahead quickly, and he felt the best way to do that was to do the interpreting for the patient, and, well, if the patient didn't accept the interpretation, the patient was resisting. I think Lacan's approach was really it just doesn't do that much good to try to hand over some sort of consciously formulated and articulated knowledge to the patient. The patient has to formulate things herself, and that's what has the most impact on the patient. Mm. So that's where Lacan then sort of veers off into something which I think a lot of people find curious, if not problematic, which is this notion of oracular interpretation, where it's not that the analyst does nothing, but that when the analyst speaks, the what is said is not terribly clear or can be interpreted in a couple of different ways. And that puts the analysand to work, and it puts the analysand's unconscious to work, trying to, with the hope that what you've said resonates somehow, that you've picked certain ambiguous phrases or phraseology from the patient's own discourse, repeated it in a certain way, such that the patient begins to wonder, I wonder what the heck that means. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily what the analyst means by that, that could be part of it, but insofar especially as it's a phrase that was taken directly perhaps from the analysand's own speech, you know, I wonder what I meant by that.
Right. Yeah, so the oracular portion is really, I think, Lacan's exclusively, because, you know, you could attribute to Freud this other, I mean, what he said and what he did were not necessarily the same thing, but he did eventually come to the conclusion that you had to kind of interpret when the, you only interpreted when the analysand was very close, when it was on the tip of the tongue or just a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
And transference, would you just indulge me for a minute?
Yeah, sure. And I've written, as I know you're aware, I've written quite extensively on this in Fundamentals of Psychoanalytic Technique. But again, I would look at a kind of historical perspective about transference. Again, I think that Freud believed that, first of all, Freud said that you only interpret the transference when it's become an obstacle to the progress of the analytic work, which you can see is already worlds apart from what is done today, where, you know, the use of the transference is rampant and is encouraged almost to the exclusion of all else at times by certain analysts.
Yes.
So for Freud, first of all, you only interpreted the transference when it became an obstacle. And what I think Lacan added was that interpreting the transference actually doesn't get you out of the transference. I think that Freud believed for a long time, perhaps right up till the end, that you could get yourself out of some nasty transference situations by bringing to the analysand's attention the fact that a transference was taking place, that, you know, let's say the analysand thought the analyst was being seductive, and the analyst might say, just like your father was, and I think Freud thought that that would somehow liquidate the transference, as he put it, or it would attenuate the transference at that particular moment in time and make the patient's demands or anger or whatever it might be dissipate. And what Lacan points out, and there's quite a bit of evidence for this that came from unexpected quarters, is that when you interpret the transference, you very often get yourself in deeper somehow into it, that you don't, you somehow make it worse. So, for example, the very fact that you make a comment that, let's say the patient thinks you're being seductive, just like somebody in the family, might actually be taken as a seductive remark itself, right? That you're trying to seduce me with your knowledge. And when someone says, oh, you feel that I'm being critical toward you just like your mother was, there are many cases in which the patient feels that you're being critical of them with that very remark, right? Stop doing it seems to be the way they take the message. And this this was, if you're familiar with the Gill's books, two volumes called The Analysis of Transference, there's a ton of, there are quite a few transcripts in there which indicate that when the therapist whose work was followed in the course of that book and transcribed and presented, many times when they gave transference interpretations, the transference actually bogged down and got worse rather than what was supposed to happen happening. So what was supposed to happen was that by interpreting the transference, you and your analysan both step momentarily into your observing ego mode instead of from your participating ego mode. And you're supposed to both somehow step into a meta position outside of the nasty emotions involved in the transference, where you both become rational, reasonable, logical beings. And then you can discuss this, and then the other stuff goes away. The nasty emotional stuff goes away. Doesn't seem to really happen. And there may be certain occasions where something like that happens a little bit, but in general, there's no way of stepping outside of the transference. And Lacan even said quite explicitly in his own cryptic vocabulary, he said, there's no transference of the transference. And by that he meant, right, you don't get out of the transference. You're in it up to your ears, basically, regardless of what you do. And so his focus became not working with the transference explicitly, but working with all the other tools at our disposal.
So it's not, can we say that he worked within it, not interpreting it, but somehow still within it to his advantage? I mean, I don't know, that's a bad phrasing, but... yeah, I mean, did he take he took something from Freud, didn't he? In this,
certainly. Yeah. I mean, certainly he thought transference was incredibly important, and he looked at it from a structural perspective. What was going on, such that a particular transference was occurring? He tended, especially in his early work, to refer more to Freud's earlier vocabulary, which involved transferences, which were momentary transferences, not necessarily. Well, today we tend to talk about transference as a kind of global, overall thing that colors the entire analysis. What Lacan focused on, especially in the 1950s, was the kind of momentary transferences that would occur. And his way of talking about it was that a momentary transference would occur, whether it's anger or it's a more an erotic kind of transference, at a moment at which there was a bogging down of the dialectical process of the analysis. So, for example, when he talked about Freud's work with Dora, he would say, It was when Freud didn't see something in particular, when he sort of put his foot in his mouth, or rather, let's say, he made mistakes in terms of understanding what was going on, that's when the transference, a particular transference, would arise. Mm. And then it would make the situation very complicated and unwieldy. And we know what the result was,
yeah.
Right? Right. So I think Lacan preferred to think in terms of momentary difficulties in the analysis, as opposed to talking about transference as an overriding feature of the analysis.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So, and certainly didn't seem to give much credence to the way people would talk about someone as having a major mother transference to their analyst, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think his feeling was also, when such things occurred, the analyst was really positioning herself incorrectly in the analysis. And that if the work was going as it should be, in other words, you know, the patient's history was being elaborated on, dreams were being talked about, fantasies and so on, such a major mother transference shouldn't arise.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit. There's a chapter in the book. I wanted to sort of give our audience an idea about how the book is organized. There's a chapter devoted to studies on hysteria, specifically. Well, I shouldn't say specifically, especially Anna O.
Right.
Another chapter is on the interpretation of dreams. That's a very long chapter. There's a chapter on the Ratman case and Dora. And then there's a chapter on symptoms and a kind of beyond Freud chapter. But so what was curious, as I'm nearing the end of the book, I was thinking, what about, I know the technique papers, Freud's technique papers were mentioned throughout, especially toward the end, but I was just wondering what prompted your particular organization of the book, why you didn't have a book on Freudian technique, specifically on the technique papers. It was, yeah, I was wondering.
Right. I think I was tempted to write such a paper, but it's true that there isn't that much, rather to write such a chapter, there isn't that much unity to the papers on technique. Mm. They really do constitute a number of very separate texts on transference, on dream interpretation, on the beginning of analytic work, and so on. And so I didn't feel that they fell into, in any neat way, into a single chapter. There's also the more slippery question, I guess, which is that of the contradiction between the way Freud actually practiced, of course, and how he said we should practice.
Right.
And what's interesting about the papers on technique, of course, is that everything he tells us you should do or you shouldn't do, he already tried, often repeatedly, and either failed miserably at it or, you know, came to a resolution that this is what he should do, and yet didn't necessarily do so in any systematic way thereafter, mm-hmm. according to at least some of the first-person accounts that I read of people's work with Freud. So, you know, for example, he would say we shouldn't, have a kind of chummy relationship, a personal relationship with patients, and we shouldn't give them advice, for example, about what to do, and yet we know that he advised certain of his patients to marry so-and-so as opposed to some other person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all
he committed every boundary violation there, except sleeping with the patient, I think, yeah.
Right, exactly. And there are probably some who would claim he did that too, but not to the best of my knowledge. But that's a separate issue. And I do mention that at various times in the course of the book that that my general overriding sense is that Freud was a better theoretician than he was a clinician. Mm-hmm. And that perhaps partly owing to never having been analyzed, it seems like it was quite hard for him to actually practice what he preached in those papers on technique.
Right. So, again, in that vein, I was curious why you didn't include... I can guess why you might not have included the Wolfman case, because he was psychotic, or this is the... according to some, right? And so
it's
very complicated. But you didn't deal very much with Little Hans or Sidonie Sillac, you know, the so-called young homosexual woman case.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you, was that a choice that you just didn't want to write that long a book? Or
Well, the book already got much longer than I was expecting it to, and I think it's the longest one I've ever written at this point. So I did have to make a selection. I think the Little Hans case is not really a case to my mind. I mean, mm-hmm. Freud basically saw the boy once and wrote a bunch of letters to the father.
Mm-hmm.
So to my mind, it's sort of, it's not really a psychoanalytic case. It's interesting. There are some fascinating things in it, some useful things for us to learn. But there's nothing for us to learn about analytic technique, it seems to me, because there was no analysis that occurred. You know, a father talking to his son and the son drawing pictures and reporting this to Freud. Now Lacan wrote, all of Seminar 4 essentially on that case, and it's a fascinating discussion of it, which itself never seems to really come to any kind of definitive conclusion about the case. And I think that, again, that's partly because it wasn't really a case, and we don't really even know what happened, in a sense, right? We don't know what became of the boy. I think Freud came to believe that he turned into, let's say, an ordinary neurotic without any phobic symptoms anymore. Lacan seems to be more doubtful about that and wonders whether or not the boy ended up perverse. But it's anybody's anybody can, come up with a hypothesis because we don't know. So it's one of those cases where I didn't think that would be terribly valuable. The case of the Wolfman is more complicated. I at least hope to talk about a case where I felt Freud had some success.
Mm.
And again, the Wolfman case, as I mentioned in the book, my sense is that Freud, like many even contemporary clinicians, didn't have a separate technique for working with psychotics and did not even necessarily recognize that the Wolfman was psychotic.
Right.
I think Ruth McBrunswick, with whom he worked afterwards, quite clearly realized that he had had a psychotic break. Freud could have realized that quite early on, based on the hallucination that the Wolfman told him he had had as a young child. And Freud kept working with him in exactly the same way as he worked with his neurotic patients, looking for the unconscious, trying to bring out the unconscious, playing on double meanings and so on, which, to my mind, didn't really do the Wolfman any good.
Mm.
So, the Wolfman is one of those cases which is perhaps shameful in the history of psychoanalysis, but it's one of the cases from which we can learn a great deal, I think, because I believe even after Ruth McBrunswick, the Wolfman went on to work with somebody else and so on. So there's always the sense that somehow he really wasn't being helped that much.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people would say the same about Dora, but I think that there were at least certain things that happened in the case of Dora that were positive, and certainly certain things that happened that were positive in the case of the Rat Man. Again, the case of President Schreiber, the judge, is not really a case either, right? It's based on a book, his autobiography, and so I tried to stick with something clinical and clinical where I thought there was something useful for us to learn by looking at those cases closely.
In the case of homosexuality, the young homosexual, so-called, that was not really, well, that was very short, but
Failed, and I believe that at least if we follow Lacan's analysis of it, Freud seems to have made a number of the same mistakes in that case as he made with Dora, and I think I mentioned that very briefly, perhaps in some footnotes.
But
Freud seemed to have this problem with women who were quite beautiful, especially young women who were quite beautiful, that he somehow couldn't keep his eye on the ball, and tried to explore the unconscious with them, but seemed to get caught up in other things and it trying to impress them perhaps and to come up with brilliant interpretations and so on, perhaps in the hope of winning their love, which is very problematic from an analytic standpoint, right?
There's we can go on this, continue on this path, but I want to like switch it up a little bit. This is maybe a very big question, but what was for Freud the goal of analysis or the end of analysis, and how do you think, was it very different from Lacan, from Lacan's end of analysis?
Well, I think you said, did you say ends or end?
End.
Ends is good, though, I think, because I would take that up because it seems to me that Freud's notion of what the end of analysis should look like changed considerably over the course of time and what the goal of analysis was. And I think the same is true to some degree for Lacan. And Lacan explicitly formulated over and over again, he's perhaps the analyst, of course I'm not familiar with all analyst work, but the analyst who seems to have devoted the most time to trying to conceptualize what the end of an analysis should look like or what we're trying to achieve. For Freud, very early on, I think very simply, he said, you know, to the goal of analysis is to make the unconscious conscious. And I take issue with that. I think that there's you know, we have some idea what he means about that, but I think what we might say instead is that the goal is to transform the unconscious, that things that were unconscious, that were running our lives, stop running our lives. We don't necessarily have to know why exactly. We don't necessarily have to know what they were to begin with and why they were running our lives. They just have to stop running our lives. Later on, I'm sure as you're aware, in his constructions in analysis in his latest papers, you know, he talks about going beyond the bedrock of castration as a final goal of analysis, and a very complicated idea, of course.
Yes.
And what he seemed to be saying, to the best of my understanding, is that it's something we can hope for, but it's not necessarily something that he felt he brought the majority of his patients to do.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, I think he felt that in the best of cases, he could bring them to the point where they could somehow be faced with what castration involves, what it's about, whether they would go beyond the position that they were in with respect to castration or not, was one of those undecidables, and might happen in some cases, might not. Lacan similarly, I think, you know, felt that, well, let's say conceptualized what the goal of analysis was in a number of different ways over the course of time. And one of the ways that I liked he came up with, of course, quite late in life after having, you know, tortured us with various formulations like the traversing of fantasy and so on, was, you know, when the analysis is happy to be alive, the analysis has gone far enough.
Okay.
So, you know, now, you know, some people poo-poo that one too, but, you know, everyone has their own formulations that they like, and,
What about you? What do you think?
I particularly like that formulation of Lacan's.
The latest one.
I don't know if it's the latest one. There might have been other ones after that in the later 70s as well. But obviously, you know, I agree with Freud that there has to be, you know, a considerable transformation at the level of the unconscious, that an awful lot of what was unconscious and that was leading to symptom formation has not necessarily become conscious, but has been worked through, has been talked over and over, has been brought into speech and articulated in a whole variety of ways, such that it just doesn't operate in the same way. And it seems, you know, one difference again between Freud and Lacan would be that Freud seemed to hold out the idea that virtually every symptom, especially neurotic symptom that someone might present us with, can be resolved in the course of the analysis. And I think Lacan believed that as well, and Lacan in his early work talked about how symptoms were resolved or dissipated or liquidated somehow through speech, by speaking, by speaking to another person. And then later on, I think he came to the notion that, well, not all symptoms can be liquidated, completely dissipated. He talked about, came up with a number of other formulations that we won't go into here, I don't think, since that's not our main purpose. But, you know, that that the analysis can take up a different position with respect to the symptom than he or she had taken up before.
Right.
That the stance can be different, that it, they don't necessarily suffer from it in the same way as they had before. The symptom doesn't entirely disappear, but it is nevertheless impacted and changes to some degree. Then he had another formulation which was goes so far as to talk about identification with the symptom. And so another complex notion, but where I think each of them over the course of their career comes perhaps is very optimistic at the outset about how much analysis can accomplish, and become perhaps more realistic or a little bit more pessimistic about the limits of analysis later on.
Actually, you know, toward the end of the book, I noticed you did engage Lacanians a bit. And, for example, when you mentioned Verhaeghe's revival of Freud's actual neurosis, this term, and though Verhaeghe, I mean, means something different by it, because for him, it's, if I understand him correctly, it's actual neurosis is a form actually of localized psychosis. It's almost like a symptom in the body that is a dumb symptom that doesn't speak or can't be interpreted. But I don't know if that's correct. But what do you think of this and of Freud's concept and this kind of the way that certain Freudian notions are being revived and kind of transformed today?
Well, let's say that what Paul Verhaeghe has done is in the grand Lacanian tradition of taking a concept found or like a term found in Freud's work and using it for his own purposes. So, for example, I found it quite confusing when I first read what Paul was doing with the notion of actual neurosis, because in Freud's work, it isn't really a neurosis. Today we wouldn't talk about it as a neurosis. For Freud, our neurosis was just sort of any kind of nervous problem, any kind of nervous condition. And for Freud, as you're aware, the an actual neurosis was something that looked like a neurosis, and so which one thought had psychosomatic causes, but which turned out to be related to something the person was actually, or rather currently doing, like working too hard or engaging in something which I don't think anybody really engages in much anymore, coitus interruptus, and leading to a kind of, you know, a situation either of overwork and what today is called burnout, or to some sort of nervous condition, a kind of incredible buildup of tension. But the notion was that it wasn't psychosomatic in the sense that as soon as the practice stopped, as soon as one stopped overworking or one stopped engaging in coitus interruptus, the what looked like a psychosomatic symptom actually disappeared. Which suggested that there was no unconscious underpinning there, right? There was no conflict in a conflict model. There was no unconscious wish that was somehow holding the symptom in place. As soon as you stopped overworking, right, the nervous condition went away. So what Paul Verhaeghe has done then is to take that term and try to do something quite different with it. I'm not as it sounds like you're quite versed in what he does with it.
I've read an article.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's up to you whether you're convinced that it's a useful new concept, and then perhaps it's justified to take an old term and give it a new meaning. But personally, I find that a bit confusing as something, you know.
I mean, it seems that there is an effort to kind of explain new maladies or what are perceived to be new maladies and working and also new ways of working with psychosis, maybe like the Müllerian concept of, I actually wonder what you think about, because you do, I think you mentioned it maybe even in a footnote, but I'm interested in what you think about ordinary psychosis, because did you think that it comes out of Freud at all, or is it this totally, can we diagnose Anna O, for example, with like, or is this, I don't know, to be more serious, it seems to me that, you know, at the end of the day, ordinary psychosis is psychosis. It's just it's more of a clinical guide, a way of recognizing psychotic structure when it's not, you know, obvious or apparent.
Exactly. I agree completely with that.
Okay, well, wonderful. Okay.
But just to return to, you know, what Paul is trying to do, for example, with actual neurosis, I agree that there's an attempt to try to locate what is going on in cases that in the past people would have said, well, psychoanalysis is contraindicated, or cases in which no matter how much talking went on, nothing seemed to happen. And so I think what Paul's trying to do is to formulate, well, what sort of psychological situation leads to something where there's no movement, where people are stuck, where nothing seems to, no matter what gets formulated, no matter who formulates it, there's no real movement. And that's, I think, certainly a positive development. And I think the notion of ordinary psychosis is connected to that in a way. First, I think Freud would never have recognized ordinary psychosis because I think he already had trouble recognizing, fairly traditional psychosis. If we take the rat, not the rat man, but rather the wolf man as a guide. Perhaps if the Wolfman had come to Freud in the midst of a psychotic break, there would have been no problem there. And yet I think, again, Freud didn't necessarily have another method, a different method of working with somebody in the midst of a psychotic break than he had with his neurotic patients. So, the notion of ordinary psychosis, I think, is simply a recognition of what Lacan points out early on in his work, for example, in Seminar 3, that psychosis is usually triggered at a certain point. In other words, there's a psychotic break that occurs, which suggests that prior to the break, the person might be talked about as pre-psychotics. And in fact, that was the term that was used in up until the 1950s, apparently in France, that certain people were pre-psychotics. Now, perhaps it was only diagnosed after the psychotic break had occurred, so it wasn't necessarily that useful to clinicians trying to work with those people. But what Mahler adds is that a psychotic break may never occur. That, in other words, there may be a pre-psychotic in whom we can see certain psychotic features, but in whom that who never experience a break, whether that's by luck or for some other reason, is not always clear. But such people are often referred to today as resistant, treatment resistant. They have concrete thinking, and again, no matter how much the analyst tries to interpret, they don't necessarily change. They don't take on board those interpretations. It seems to me that it's a helpful category because it for me, especially since I make a very big distinction in treatment methodology between neurotics and psychotics, it alerts us to the fact that, you know, certain people who don't make slips of the tongue or who, you know, make them only very occasionally and never seem to catch on, never find them funny, never find them significant, or never able to do any creative work with them, that the unconscious in them does not operate in the same way as it does in neurotics, and there's no point trying to work with it in the same way that one does with neurotics, and that in fact, continually trying to point out to someone that maybe there's something going on that they're not aware of may produce a psychotic break when there wasn't one. And so I think it's a very helpful category in that regard, that, you know, it alerts the clinician to potential trouble or trouble that they could potentially create themselves by pushing too hard in any particular direction.
And speaking of sort of structures, diagnostic categories, etc., what about phobia? You mentioned phobia as well, only at the end you kind of avoid. I mean, you explain why you didn't do Little Hans, which I understand it's not a real case, but still, actually, Lacan really rethinks that whole rethinks Little Hans, he rereads him completely, but. You know, what do you make of this? Because I have trouble understanding phobia as a form of, as a kind of structure, you know. And I was wondering if you think it, in fact, is a structure or is it just a symptom or... It seems difficult for me, I don't know, it's difficult for me to think of it as a structure.
Yeah,
I am... Do you encounter it in your clinic?
Oh, I do. Yes, I do. Uh-huh. And, but... You know, very often it looks like part of a broader structure, let's say of hysteria. What we find a lot of phobias early in people's lives, which are passing often. You know, they don't necessarily last beyond long beyond childhood. And so it seems that it's a phobia is often just one neurotic symptom among many. But there are cases of lifelong phobia, and Lacan came around to talking about those as what he thought of as the, let's say, the most radical form of neurosis, in the sense that it's closest to there not being the name of the father, or there not being a button tie, there not being some sort of anchoring point for the subject. And so it's as if it's almost the worst case scenario of neurosis, and in that case, perhaps the hardest to treat. But Freud himself, I think, just considered it to be, you know, a symptom among others, and perhaps if he, you know, he would have included it under the psychoneuroses. I mean, I don't know of anyone who's really worked so extensively with phobias to come up with a fundamentally different structure for it, let's say, from the way they formulate obsession and hysteria.
Mm.
So your sense about it is that it's not a separate structure?
Yeah, well, I think that I was never totally convinced by it as a separate structure. I wasn't sure how I would then, if I encountered, even if I were to kind of delineate it, or if I were to recognize it in a patient, how I would then approach the patient differently. You know, what would be the kind of direction of the treatment?
Right.
Yeah, so I was curious. And, you know, I'm on the fence, I guess, about
right.
it. Yeah.
Certainly my sense about it is that it's one of the neuroses, whether we consider it to be a thoroughly separate one from hysteria or obsession, I wouldn't be so sure about that. But in terms of the approach to working with it, I think it's very much like the other neuroses.
So, Okay. Well, as is customary at the New Books Network, I will end. We're going to end soon, and I want to ask you before we go what you're working on now.
What I'm working on now, I am deep into the translation of Seminar 6, which is called Desire and its Interpretation. And this is, I believe, the longest seminar of Lacan's. It's 600 pages.
Wow.
So
you sound thrilled about it.
Well, to be quite honest, it's one of the early ones, and I'm not quite as interested in it as the later ones, but I made a deal with a publisher that I would do an early one, and they are promising me two later ones. So, you know, I'm doing my best to keep my interest up, and there's a long section in there. There's seven or eight classes devoted to Hamlet, which can be amusing and infuriating and so on. But there's a great deal actually on the interpretation of dreams, and so the whole first section is actually on the interpretation of dreams, and I actually found that quite useful for working on the Freud book. And the other thing I'm toying with at this point will be another Inspector Canal story to be tentatively entitled The Da Vinci Staircase, and which will make fun of the Da Vinci Code, of course, in so many ways because of all its absurdities, but at least ones I was able to detect, and also to just integrate certain of the lovely architectural things here in France and certain castles. So that's more a fun project, and that is more on the back burner than on the front burner right now.
Well, I look forward to both, but I don't know. I love your translation, so I can't wait. You're going to make Seminar 6 really interesting or accessible.
I hope so. Right. Accessible at least. Let's hope. Right. Yes.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you very much for doing this yet again. I've been talking to Bruce Fink about his book, A Clinical Introduction to Freud, Techniques for Everyday Practice. Thanks again, Bruce.
Oh, thank you so much, Anna, for taking the time to read the book and for preparing questions for me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
You too. And thanks to our audience for listening. Until next time.
So long.